one of the agents whispered into my ears when he caught up with me while I was waiting for the subway for the A train from Queens to Manhattan. So it was dark and cold in a December morning, and he whispered to me, they already had given me signals, and so I had not responded to the signals. And he whispered to me, he says, you know, you got to come home or else you're dead.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. When I was working at the CIA in the Counterterrorism Center, I had a friend there who was not a very good case officer. He was a lovely guy, but the work just wasn't really for him. His name was Joe Weisberg. One day I went into the office and he walked up to me and he said, hey, I quit today. I said, you quit? What are you going to do? He said, well, I'm not married. I don't have any kids. So I think I'm going to go to Hollywood and find my fortune. He wrote a novel that was pretty good. It was redacted by the CIA in parts, but it was pretty good. And then I saw him in the New York Times as the creator of the hottest new TV show in America. It was called The Americans. And it went for 7 seasons. It made him rich beyond his wildest dreams. But this show was about something called KGB illegals. They were people who live in the United States, all across the country, and present as Americans. But in fact, they're working secretly for the KGB. It was a fantastic idea for a TV series. Well, today, I am delighted to speak with somebody who actually was a KGB illegal. Jack Barsky spent a decade spying in the United States under a false identity before ultimately severing his ties with Soviet intelligence and building a new life as an American citizen. His story combines Cold War intrigue with a striking personal transformation from a committed communist to an outspoken critic of the system that once employed him. He was born in East Germany. He was a gifted student who became a chemistry lecturer before being secretly recruited by the KGB in the 1970s. Selected for this elite illegals program because of his intelligence and his aptitude for foreign languages, which is very important in that world. He underwent years of intensive training in tradecraft, in surveillance, in clandestine communications in East Germany. In 1979, he entered the United States under the stolen identity Jack Philip Barsky, based on the birth certificate of a deceased American child, and he quietly began his new existence as a sleeper agent. Jack settled in New York. He obtained legitimate employment, eventually in the insurance and IT industries, and focused on building his new American cover while carrying out relatively low-level intelligence tasks like profiling potential recruits and reporting on U.S. public opinion during key Cold War crises. Over time, he got married, he started a family, and he found himself increasingly drawn to ordinary American life, which gradually eroded his ideological commitment to communism. In the late 1980s, after ignoring an urgent KGB recall order, he cut himself off from Moscow using a fabricated story about having contracted HIV, betting that the Soviets would not then come after him. He was right. Years later, though, the FBI confronted him and he cooperated fully, becoming a valuable source of information on KGB methods and ultimately avoiding any prosecution. Today, Jack is a U.S. citizen, he's a corporate IT professional, and he's a public speaker known for his memoir, Deep Undercover, in which he reflects on identity, loyalty, and redemption. So I am just tickled pink to be able to welcome Jack Barsky to the show. Jack, thank you for joining us. We're so glad to have you.
Delighted, and this was the best introduction I've ever heard. So that summary, with that summary, we can maybe conclude the session here.
Right. We'll just call it a day.
So, but you said ordinary American life. I will want to change this to extraordinary. The life that I created here for myself was phenomenal. And I'm not a corporate individual anymore. Now I'm an entrepreneur, which is not quite as phenomenal, but more interesting.
There you go. There you go. I wasn't kidding when I said that Joe Weisberg created something in the Americans that was just captivating.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people over the years asked me, is that true? Did the KGB really do something like that? And the answer is, oh, yes. And not only did they do it, but they did it quite successfully. It was as recently as 3 or 4 years ago that a group of illegals was outed right here in my own neighborhood in Arlington, Virginia. So let's start with the beginning. Tell us how you fell into this. How did they come to approach you? And how did they pitch it to you that made you think that this is something you might like to be involved in?
I can only with certainty only tell you what I personally experienced, because the KGB gave me next to no background information. This, and that makes a lot of sense, because if you send an illegal to another country and they're supposed to be, you know, merge into the population and become like, I was impersonating a born American. If you're really successful, you're much more likely to defect. And so that's why they didn't give me any information other than, and what I will tell you some things that I found out afterwards, but I tell you how I was, this is a guess, how I came to the attention of the KGB. I'm pretty sure that they had access to the files of top universities, just like the CIA and other intelligence services. They were looking for candidates in top universities, and particularly for candidates of a certain age, where they already were mature enough to know who they are, but most likely not yet settled. So when I was approached, I was in my early 20s, and I didn't have a steady girlfriend at the time. But in the files under Albrecht Dittrich, that was my German name, it was clear that I was an outstanding student. I had received a scholarship, a national scholarship that was limited to only 100 concurrent holders in the entire country. So that meant I also, not only did I have good grades and the best grades, but I also was active. I was a party member. I was active in the Communist Youth Movement. And to round it all out, I also was in the starting lineup of the college basketball team. So we have an interesting candidate that we need to, you know, talk to. And so the first meeting I had was not a recruitment whatsoever. It was just getting to know you, because what they knew was that I was smart and I was a communist and probably some other things about my personal life. What they didn't know was, did I have what it takes to function in what I consider, from an intellectual point of view and the overall behavioral point of view, the toughest job in intelligence, because it's a lone wolf undercover illegal where you have to make all your decisions by yourself. There's no boss. There's no colleagues. You by yourself. And so I found out what they were looking for. And they actually studied me for 18 months before they made the offer. But they were looking for, among others, like quick decision-making. They were looking for lack of fear, bravery. They were looking for the ability to just say goodbye to the current situation and have no problem with, you know, changing everything in life. And they were looking for, did I have the ability to reach out to strange individuals, introduce myself, befriend them, and find information from them? It's elicitation. They gave me some tasks to do. They were really uncomfortable, but, you know, I couldn't fail. Failure was for me, okay, that was never an option. And my favorite is inclination, well-controlled inclination for adventure. So, and I had this, my inclination for adventure was really in childhood, not very well controlled, because I did a lot of things that I shouldn't have done as a child, like climb trees that couldn't hold me, and I would fall down and I'd break something, and run around barefoot and playing soccer and step onto glass shards and on and on. So I was a very high risk individual. And one more I want to mention is the ability to come up with a clever lie on the spot to get you out of a tough situation. So that's a quick response to fluid situations. That was code for lying.
Allow me to ask you about that, because that's a theme that comes up in the Americans over and over and over again. You have to be able to think very quickly on your feet, and it has to be not just a lie, but a clever lie, as you just said.
Yes.
Was that hard? Was that hard to do, or did it come naturally to you?
It came naturally to me. I, you know, most people, when they lie, the lie is very often worse than what they're trying to cover up, because it gives them away. I could project forward how this might play if it's being investigated. So I was blessed with a very fast brain, very, very fast brain. And the speed of a brain, I don't think it has been measured, but it's not as fast as it used to be. But for my age, it's pretty darn good still.
Oh, God bless. I wanted to ask you, too, what was the, or was there a single decisive moment when your loyalty shifted from the Soviet cause to the life that you had built in America? And why do you think it shifted?
Okay, now if you're talking about the loyalty to, say, communism and the country I was born in, and to becoming a loyal American, that was a very lengthy process. Very lengthy process. And I tell you, it was good that it was a lengthy process, because the decontamination that pretty much was engaged in myself by finding out more and more information about how we were lied to and how things were not the way we thought they were. And also how we were lied to, how bad capitalism is. You know, I experienced this slowly. And by comparison, you know, people that my age, you know, fellow classmates, fellow students, when Germany was reunified, it hit them like a 2x4 over the head. They did not have the luxury of time, and all of a sudden everything changed. And it's for some of them, and I met some, it felt like they, like a long-term prisoner who has been in prison for 10 years and is being let out into society and is not functional. I had a friend who had pretty high chess ranking. He played Karpov to a draw one time in a simultaneous match. I still have the record of that. And when the wall came down, he couldn't find another job. He could not find a job because he was used to being taken care of. And he was like so miserable. So, you know, again, the shift in loyalty was a very slow one. It started initially with understanding that the lies about what America was all about they were just lies. When I had my first corporate job in an insurance company, I was looking for the evil capitalists, and I couldn't find any, because it felt more like in insurance in those days, it were very paternalistic. They took care of the employees, and it felt like, okay, it's just like I'm employed in East Germany again. It was, you know, we got free lunch, and people were very nice. There were some idiot bosses like the, you find them everywhere. But point being, that was the first lie. But the worst lies that I had to find out after the wall came down, I was so surprised, like everybody else. The CIA was surprised. The KGB was surprised. Nobody predicted that spontaneously – the East German nation would rise up and succeed in breaking down that wall. So I was surprised. And at that point, I didn't have to go to the library because the internet was available already. And I could do a lot of research in my spare time. And of course, I did the research and I found out, for instance, I found unredacted works of Vladimir Lenin. Lenin was a hero to us in East Germany. He was the founder of the of communist Russia and then founded the Soviet Union. And he died because he took such sacrifices with his life. And he was also injured in an assassination attempt. And he was a smart guy. And he implemented Marxism-Leninism, which to us was taught like a science. Marxism-Leninism predicted that it was inevitable that the future of mankind would be in a communist paradise where there would everybody, that was the motto, everybody according to their ability and to everybody according to their needs. That sounded really romantic and it was sold as a science. And Lenin implemented something like that. Well, when I had access to unredacted writings of Vladimir Lenin, I very quickly found out that he was just as murderous a bastard as Stalin was, possibly even more evil, except he didn't have as many tools to kill as many people, because when Stalin had the forerunners of the KGB, and he used that group to do the killing for him and populate the gulags for him. But Lenin was just, I mean, he seeded the nonsense. So at that point, I already had the person in my life that made me stay in the United States when they called me back, as you pointed out. And that was an 18-month-old daughter, a child who I had unexpectedly. First of all, she was born because mom decided to. It was a good idea to keep me as a dad around because I told her I wasn't. You know, I married. She was illegal in the country, and I married her to get her a green card, and that worked. And I told her that once you got your green card, we're going to get divorced again. And she didn't quite follow that rule. She stopped taking the pill and got pregnant on purpose. And all of a sudden, the illegal KGB agent became an American dad holding a baby. So, and I don't know. I've talked to many men who have girls as children, girls and boys, but when we men, when we first hold a girl, something happens to us, and this was unexpected. I wasn't even aware of it, but I just fell in love with this child. And when she was 18 months old, by the time the KGB called me back, she wasn't really talking yet, but she had the biggest, wonderful, pretty brown eyes and nice hair. And so every time I came home from work, she was just. She was in a playpen, an enclosure. So, yeah. She would just climb up and look over the grate there and look at me, and without saying it, the eyes just said, "I love you, Dad." And that was the first time in my life that I didn't even understand it, but I experienced unconditional love. But up until that point, I was just in love with, I wanted to have a girlfriend. I was in love with myself a lot because I was so damn good. Everything I touched, I succeeded at. And I was praised by a lot of people. So I was just an arrogant young man. And all of a sudden, I was in love with this innocent being that couldn't even tell me anything yet. And that is that young lady is responsible for me talking to you today. So when you're looking for a specific moment, and this moment I will never forget, I knew I would be called back eventually. The tour of duty typically was about 10 to 12 years. I was in my 11th year. Again, they didn't want to keep illegals around too long because the risk of defection would grow the longer you keep them there in the country. So I knew I would have to leave, and I couldn't find a way to support her, this child by the name of Chelsea, and her mother. There was no way for me to support her from a distance, and I couldn't ask anybody for help. So I didn't know what to do. And I kicked the can down the road until they, in no uncertain terms, told me, "You got to come home." And this literally, I'm quoting something that one of the agents whispered into my ears when he caught up with me when I was waiting for the subway for the A train from Queens to Manhattan. So it was dark and cold in a December morning, and he whispered to me, "They already had given me signals," and so I had not responded to the signals. And he whispered to me, he says, "You know, you got to come home or else you're dead," in a Russian accent. Now, Russian accent or not, maybe he used awkward language, but you had to take this seriously. So, and I now had to follow instructions. They asked me you know what a dead drop operation is?
Oh, yes, I do.
Okay, yes. So dead drop is when, for the listeners or the viewers, is when you hand over something that has size, such as money, a passport, whatever else, objects rather than information. And they called me for a dead drop operation to get a passport and money so I can make my way to Canada and eventually ring the bell at the Soviet embassy, where they would then get me out of the country and get me back home. So this was an interesting operation. It was the only operation that they scheduled for the dark at night on Staten Island. It was a spot that I couldn't miss because I found it myself. And it was so easy to find and so easy to describe that there was no way that this operation would fail. And guess what? There's a signal that the person said who supposedly put a crushed oil can at the bottom of a hollowed big tree. And I saw that signal, the chalk mark. It said, you know, it's there, go get it. So I'm going into the park, and that tree was impossible to miss. And there was no oil can. So that's a shock. And it was dark and cold. There was nobody in the park. So I turned the flashlight on and I walked around and walked around and walked around. Couldn't find anything. So eventually, after like 15 minutes, I gave up. There was the only drop operation that failed. I'm thinking that was an intervention by God or whatever. So it was not plausible. So, and here's the moment that I remember as I'm walking out of this park and I set foot on the sidewalk that is parallel to the park. There's three words that came to me from my subconscious. I am staying. That was, from a rational perspective, the dumbest decision I could have ever made, because here's the reason. Rationally, everything that was good for me was back in behind the Iron Curtain, behind the wall. The wall was still up in those days. Everything that was threatening for me, for my existence, was in the United States. because the KGB told me through Morse code that most likely the FBI is investigating me. And if I tell the KGB I'm not coming home, they could interpret this as a defection. So for me to stay, all I would be able to stay with my girl for a while, but then I could be arrested or, worse yet, assassinated by the KGB. That was not out of the question. I could have rationalized all of this, but my instinct, my subconscious, my love overrode all of that. And I made that quote-unquote dumb, yet the very best decision in my entire life.
I want to ask you too, in my own career, I spent many, many years, not just overseas, but overseas undercover. And in some cases, under pretty sophisticated deep cover. It's not unusual to get confused sometimes by your own cover. I once answered the phone using the wrong name, for example, and then I ended up just hanging up on the person. They called back and I made it seem as if, no, they must have dialed a wrong number. What was it like for you to live every day with this deep cover? What aspect of maintaining a completely fabricated identity was the most difficult for you psychologically on a day-to-day basis?
I have to disappoint you. It didn't feel that difficult. Now, here's the thing. I did not operate in the same language. So there's no way that I could answer the phone and say, hey, this is Albrecht Dittrich. And when I went back to Germany and people would say my name, I didn't even see him. I turned around. So what happened was that I had manufactured a dual personality for myself. And there's pretty much proof that I have. So, when, as I just told you, every 2 years, I traveled back to Moscow for some debriefing and some more training if the training was necessary. And then I spent time with my German family. And so, again, when somebody used my German first name, I would respond. So now I go back to the United States. And I always traveled with a shortwave radio just in case I'm stuck someplace and I need to receive Morse code. But when I was in reach to get an American radio station, I was eager to find out how the Yankees were doing in the playoffs. So the American was back in business. So I in an interview with a German news magazine, Der Spiegel, I sort of compared this that I had two compartments in here. And one was passive in the back and the other one was active. As soon as I never had a problem impersonating Jack Barsky in the United States. Okay. And it got a little more difficult to be Albrecht Dittrich, the German.
How did the KGB's vision of the United States differ from what you came to see the United States as being?
Well, when you say the KGB, you need to differentiate between the ones who were subject to the propaganda and never been to the United States, and then the people that had been to the United States. And they were all, when they operated in the U.S., they were all under diplomatic cover. So what they knew and what they proudly displayed is the wealth was prevalent in the U.S. and attainable to like middle-class citizen people. So yeah, it never failed that when it was really cold outside in Moscow winter, teachers, trainers, coaches would show up in clothes that were bought at Macy's or Saks Fifth Avenue and were proudly displaying the clothes that they had. You know, you didn't, I mean, that was normal to them. So they knew the standard of living was higher. they most likely knew that there wasn't as much evil prevalent in the United States. But I think they were still emotionally and intellectually attached to the communist cause. I mean, when you get that brainwashed from kindergarten on, that is very, very difficult to wipe out. And so they rationalized, okay? And they were very happy I was looking forward to that too. They were happy to serve a higher cause, right? Communism, worldwide communism, and yet have your cake and eat it too, you know? And so, this is what I noticed with those guys, but there's one thing that they didn't know. And they didn't know what they didn't know. Right. So, and I give this an example that will illustrate what I'm talking about. First of all, they spoke with an accent. They lived, some of them had their families in the United States. They lived in a compound up in the north of Manhattan, where they were all, and then they went to work in New York. This was all at the United Nations, either as part of the Soviet contingent or employees of the UN. As such, they didn't have a clue what it was like to live as an American. So this is where I'm using the example of a big aquarium in Atlanta, Georgia, where I lived for a while. They have this huge aquarium where you can stand in front of this thing, and they have sharks in there, all kinds of living creatures that live in the water, and it's fascinating. Yeah, but me watching these fish, I didn't know what it's like to be a fish. And so the diplomats never had to go find a job, never had to find an apartment. They just did not know what it was like to be an American. And the instructions that they gave me were all false from A to Z. You know, they gave me all kinds of ideas. This is how you go about getting a driver's license. This is how you go get your social security card. This is where you should find a job, such as a taxi driver or a stevedore. By the way, this is, I found out these jobs, the stevedore is highly unionized, at least it was. So I couldn't get that. Taxi driver, forget it. So I started out as a messenger. I had to figure this all out. Now that's why they hired somebody like me. But the thing is that within the system of the Soviet Union and within the KGB, the folks that had been on the diplomatic cover in the United States were the ones that knew everything. And everybody said, oh, yeah, you've been there. You've seen it. And so the most dangerous thing in life is with regard to knowledge and ignorance, not to know what you don't know.
That's right. Go
ahead.
Before we get to the next question, I want to read an ad from our sponsor. While many of us are distracted by headlines, a real transformation is underway, at least within the monetary system, and that's the rise of the digital dollar. 134 countries, including the United States, are developing central bank digital currencies. That means your transactions will be tracked, your spending controlled, your savings vulnerable to instant freezing. This is what the current public policy is moving toward. Bureaucrats and those suspicious folks at our nation's three-letter agencies would love nothing more than to have more information about you. The government is calling it innovation, but let's call it what it is. It's financial surveillance. American Alternative Assets has put together a free guide that shows you how to protect your retirement with physical gold. It's called The Digital Dollar Trap, and it's something every freedom-minded American should read. Inside the free guide, you'll discover how to protect yourself from government overreach, with physical assets like gold and silver. So go to johnlovesgold.com right now to get your guide totally free. That's johnlovesgold.com, because if the dollar is going digital, you'll need something real. Thanks for taking that pause.
Oh, Jack, yeah. Can I add to this?
Yes, please.
If our currency goes digital, there goes the freedom.
Mm-hmm.
There goes the freedom, because
I agree completely.
Human nature, if you're near the top or wants to go to the top, and people want to control other people, and the financial tools are more dangerous than any kind of weapon you can think
without
of.
Doubt.
You can't run away from that. You're enslaved.
Jack, when the FBI finally approached you, well, first of all, do you know how it was that they figured it out? And secondly, what made you decide to cooperate with the FBI, especially to the extent that you did?
Yeah, well, that was a no-brainer, because I had a family. I had a house in the country. I had a good job. I had a beautiful wife and two children. And I had quit the KGB. So for me, returning to Germany, I could have possibly gone to Germany, but I don't know what I would have done, what they would have done with me. The United German country, I certainly wouldn't have been very welcome.
Right.
So I had become an American. Also, that was, let me see, I don't want to misstate this. When did 9/11 happen? What year?
2001.
2001. So 9/11 had not happened yet. But, you know, I had so many friendships and relationships. You know, I had created my version of the American dream, and it felt really good. So I didn't want to leave that. How they found out, there was an archivist in the first directorate of the KGB. First directorate was espionage. And he was the lead archivist, and he oversaw the movement of the archives, including that was included in the move of the headquarters from Lubyanka, you know, right there at the Red Square, to Yasinovo, where the KGB had their new headquarters. And this guy had developed an incredible hatred for the Soviet system. There was a security breach here. He had access to every little page that was written there, and he copied some stuff, handwritten, and with small pieces of paper, and smuggled them out every night, a few pieces of paper, in his underwear and in his socks. Again, they let him go out there. Nobody ever patted him down or anything like that. And over time, it took years. He transcribed what he wrote down on the pieces of paper, and typed the result into larger pieces of paper, and buried all that stuff in a dacha. And it was in just about close to a year after the Soviet Union collapsed and the KGB ceased to exist, he decided to share what he had. Initially, he approached the American embassy on a weekend, and there was a junior officer as a guard, and he told him that we are not interested in that. This is old stuff. That was a career-limiting move, because Vasily Mitrokhin, that was the guy's name, he then went to one of the Baltic republics and told MI6 what he had. And MI6 said, well, let's come on in. Let's have a cup of tea. So they had a cup of tea, and they managed to smuggle several boxes worth of typewritten intelligence, the most valuable intelligence in the history, with one exception, and that was the atomic secret. But then MI6 shared the relevant stuff with the FBI, and amongst the notes, there was just a couple of words. It says, there is an illegal who lives in the northeast of the United States, and his last name is Barsky. Well, if last name was Smith, then I probably wouldn't be talking to you today. So the Barsky was relatively easy to find, and there were some Barskys, and this I was told by the person who was in charge of the investigation, the lead agent, who is now a good friend of mine, another oddity in my life. They found out there were like maybe a handful or half a dozen Barskys, and the one that got his social security number at the age of 38, 39, that must have been him because everybody else got it early. So, and they spent I think it was altogether 5 years. No, it was, I don't want to misspeak. It was at least 2 years to observe me from a distance because other than the name and that I wasn't illegal, they didn't know anything. I could still be active. And if I was still active and they get really close, they knew one thing. I had survived, at that point, like 14 years in the United States undetected. So I was really well trained, and if I'm still looking for surveillance, I'll find it. And so they watch me from a distance.
One of the questions that I get very, very frequently is, because I underwent so much training over the years, do I continue to look for surveillance? Do I continue to spot, assess, develop, sources of information? And at least as far as the surveillance goes, I can't help myself. I'm constantly looking for surveillance. Are you the same way or no?
No.
It's past.
It's
interesting.
It's truly past. There's one residue that I can't get rid of. And if somebody knocks at my door, I go like this. You can ring the bell, that's fine, but the knock. But other than that, surveillance, no. I stopped looking for surveillance once I decided, when I told when I sent my goodbye letter to the KGB, I spent another like 6 weeks counter surveillance and did all kinds of measures to see even if the FBI is investigating me. One of the methods, I'm sure you know, that you write a letter to yourself. Mm-hmm. And sure. you don't glue the entire letter. You keep an inch unglued because the letters are, people can't open the letters. They do damage. So they're opened by machines and glued back by machines. The machine glues everything, right? So I know you're nodding. And, you know, there is some kind of an international standard how to operate in secrecy. I have a friend who is legend amongst retired CIA. And every time we meet, when we exchange information, what, you did that too? You know, one
the
time.
The tradecraft doesn't change much from country
that's
to
right.
country.
So how did I got sidetracked here? So how they found me, told you. And why I cooperated, it was a no-brainer. The one thing I just wanted to point out, the producers of The Americans were like elated to find out that in my case, the FBI bought the house next door because they had a series, they had FBI living next door. Mm-hmm. And I had FBI living next door for me and next to me for a while.
Unbelievable. Well, we will leave it there. Jack Barsky, again, such an incredible treat. Jack is a Fortune 500 and IT consultant, and he's the author of an absolutely wonderful book. It's been out for a little while, but you can still find it. It's called Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. Thanks again for joining us. And ladies and gentlemen, please help us bring you more conversations like this by liking, sharing, and subscribing. Please tell your friends and family. We're coming right up on 100,000 subscribers. I can't tell you how much that means to all of us here. Thanks again for joining us. I'm John Kiriakou. This is Deep Focus.